This podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license. Please include this license notice with any copy or derivative of this work. Recorded at Skillswap Brighton on the 9th of July 2008, this is Mike Stenhouse's presentation, From Ego to Ergo, Using Influence in Design. Thanks to magex.com and lighthouse.org.uk for their support in putting on this event. Without further ado, I'll hand over to Mike Stenhouse.
Can you hear me at the back all right? Is that okay? Yeah. Okay, ace. Too dark.
Too dark.
Too loud?
Too dark.
Black like my soul. Yes, right. Okay, so my name's Mike. I'm a user experience, interaction, user interface, something designer. And as such, I spend most of my days trying to figure out how to make people do the things that they want to do, but they don't necessarily know they want to do yet. And I've got a slightly unhealthy interest in why people do things, which is what this is about. I'm just going to kick off with the inspiration for this talk, which is slightly sideways. This is my hallway for my Avoca flats in London. I live in Shoreditch, which is why we've got so many mirrors. and this is a sideboard that was left there by one of the residents. And it was there for about a week. And nothing happened, so someone left a little note. But they also happened to forget their pen. And within a day, a conversation occurred. Now, I actually met a guy at ETech about a year ago who was doing his PhD on this. He was putting bits of paper in public spaces and pens and just seeing what might happen. And it turns out that given very, very little prodding, people like to talk about stuff. And, disclaimer, I am a recovering Egyptologist. I have a master's in Egyptology, so I like old stuff, which is why I have slides of old stuff. The Greeks were writing graffiti around the pyramids from 400 AD. The Victorians got straight on it as soon as they went abroad. We've continued that with toilet humour and MySpace. One slide. But why I like this is because if you'd ask someone whether they would have a conversation in public, they'd probably say no. And at the time this sideboard was left in the hallway, I was reading a bit about Maslow and Manfred Max Neef, who were coming up with this idea that there are fundamental human needs and there are fundamental human drivers. And what I like about this quote is that we're not always aware of our motivation. We're not always aware of what we're doing. And as a designer, I spend an awful lot of my time trying to make people do what they're not consciously aware they want to do, which is what this talk's all about. I was going to try and make it this nice, flowing, sensible narrative. It's actually just a bunch of stuff that I like. If you find a bit that's boring, don't worry, it won't be around for long. We'll be on to something else soon. Or throw things at me. It's up to you. Clearly, I have to start with Darren Brown. And this is, The Map Is Not the Territory, it's a great quote. It's a similar idea to what Gladwell called thin slicing, you know, where he says, you know, you judge people very, very quickly and you have your intuition. I think we do this with almost everything. There was a study done in 1974 of the Canadian federal elections. And what they were doing was seeing how good-looking candidates fared against less good-looking candidates. And it turns out that more attractive candidates were getting 2.5 times more votes than their less attractive co-runners. But when anyone in the survey was asked if they were affected by the attractiveness of the candidates, all of them, of course, deny it completely, because that would make no sense. You know, why would you vote for someone who's good-looking, which bodes well for Obama and not so well for our mate Gordon? It also turns out that good-looking people get better jobs. There was a set of negligence cases staged where they had, all defendants had been found guilty at this point, so they were all guilty of something, right? And all the jury had to do was pick how their sentence was going to go. So it's going to be a fine of some sort. The good-looking people paid about $10,000 on average. I've spoiled the punchline. you know what's coming, don't you? Okay, the not so good looking people pay 10,000, good looking people get 10,000. And this is in a court of law where we absolutely should not be affected by something as superficial as that. So, how this applies to products, I'm calling it products, web stuff, whatever it is you're making. If you make something beautiful, people can get very, very attracted to it. If you can quietly tweak their ego, I mean, this is a classic sales tactic. It's flattery, plain and simple. It's in personal sign-up, and it's implying that anyone who signs up is a cool person. It's quite obvious, but it works. Everyone likes to think they're cool. Something like, I want Sandy. It's just very likable, actually. I love the wording of this. It's completely conversational. What would you like as your password? Can you type that password again for me? Giving it personality and making it very, very personable. Flickr has its kind of cute hellos. Ahoy, pirate speak. Delicious library. I never really got Delicious library. I don't exactly know why I'd want to use it. I know what's on the bookshelf because it's sitting in front of me. Why would I spend the time scanning my bookshelf so I can look at my bookshelf on my computer?
Insurance purposes.
Okay, maybe it's that. But apart from being beautiful and clever, apparently when you add a Star Wars title, it says, I am your father. when you add Rock Band, it sings you a portion of Run to the Hills by Iron Maiden. When Harry Met Sally, I kind of wish it did, but apparently it doesn't. But you can't underestimate this kind of joy factor in how people feel about your products and how they perceive you. Doctor's another one. Their logo changes depending on where you're going. And it's the kind of thing you're probably not going to notice until you've been using it for a while. It's that minute of delight. The iTunes player during Glastonbury went up to 11. Of course it goes up to 11, it's rock and roll. eBay gives you a special phone number when you level up and you become a certain level of power user. You're not expecting it, they don't advertise it, they just give it to you. With the Obama logos, because you know, he's gone crazy on these, right? He's got a logo for every possible niche in America. And check this out. So who'd you vote for? Obama, he's got cool logos over there in New York. It actually does work. And the king of lovable products is, of course, Apple. But who do you know who's not had trouble with Apple? Apple hardware failing, hard drives failing, crashing when Leopard came out like a crazy thing. Steve's a cruel, cruel master, but we still love our Apple products. Now, I'm straight off into marketing for this. It's a book called Influence, which is amazing and everyone should read. Mostly this guy, he's a psychology professor, and he studies influence professionals, so he's worked as a waiter, he's worked as a car salesman, anyone whose job it is to influence other people. And loads of the case studies I've got come from this one book. And the first section of the book I'm going to go through is social proof, because that turns up a lot in software, particularly on the web, where we have lots and lots of users. And social proof is originally this kind of evolved survival instinct, safety in numbers. And despite the fact it's a survival instinct, technically, most of the textbook examples of social proof are about suicide. There's what's called the Werther effect, which is named after The Sorrows of Young Werther, which is this book by Goethe, which started turning up in the bedroom of young suicide victims. Turns out the character in the book commits suicide when he's, it doesn't go quite so well with his lady friend. After Marilyn Monroe's death, in the 2 weeks following that, there was a 12% increase in suicide by overdose. There's some terrifying, terrifying statistics about car wrecks, plane wrecks, and high school shootings following high-profile suicides. Turns out that we're incredibly affected by what other people do around us, even if we don't know them, even if we have nothing in common with them. And this turns up in kind of fairly obvious marketing copy, 37 signals. Over 1 million people and businesses use our web-based applications. 1 million people can't be wrong, right? Oh, and of them, 94% like it. And you wouldn't think this would have much effect on you, but it's the same reason that so much money's been poured into viral advertising. It spreads the web like wildfire. It comes from your fans. And actually, this is the second type of social proof. You have one which is the mass effect, and you have the other which is the very personal effect. When your friends send you something, I hate this quote, but this is why people like it. Here's the cool thing about Twitter. It's side-by-side communication. Here's a picture of Dan and I. Say, Dan, Twitter's, hey, I found this amazing site, go check it out. Do I question it? Do I have my defences up? No, I go straight there. It sort of misses the point of what Twitter's about, right? But it's social proof in action, and it does work. People are making shitloads of money off this stuff. It goes under your radar. And if you put the two together, what you end up with is something like the Facebook advertising scheme, where they have both. So we have both my mates Steph and George have become fans of TED, along with 3,800 other people. This is social proof in action. You've also got it in slightly less obviously social context, with featuring the previous 800,000 people, can't be wrong. They did a study on, what was it? It was towel recycling in hotels. And you know, you go to the hotel and you get your free towels, right? And they give you a card that says, please recycle your towels, save water, save the environment. And some people do it, some people don't. The environment's a motivator for certain sets of people. They changed the wording to read 85% of people who stayed in this hotel recycled their towel. And they had a 25% increase in recycling. Now, these are 85% of people who stay in this hotel, who you've never met and you are never going to meet, and may or may not have anything in common with you. But it affects people massively. This is Trigg, a bit like MySpace, slightly nicer than MySpace. They use social proof with how popular people are and use it as sort of a scoring system, and it becomes this kind of karma exchange type thing, popularity. Oh, actually, MySpace use it too. MySpace get a lot of flack for this with their collecting of friends. If you think about how MySpace started, it was supposed to be a promotional site for bands, and a perfectly valid promotional tool is how many fans have you got? What are the charts for? Who's number one? And so they've used social proof for bands. It's then become a sort of social site, and it counts against them, the kind of the collecting of friends. But for where they started, it's perfectly acceptable. And if you don't think of MySpace as social software, which I actually quite want to do, it's quite a good use of it. A nicer use of it is Flickr. So mostly they hide their social proof stats down the bottom. So views, favorites. But then they use it when it comes to search, when you reach a decision point, when you reach a point where you need to know how valuable a picture is. They start to release the stats to the top. So you can use them to gauge how useful something's going to be. Now remember I said 85% of people who stayed at the hotel, right? Well, there's also similarity. They reworded that particular... Do you know the whole Lemmings thing was a complete hoax, by the way? You know Disney staged it? Lemmings don't jump off cliffs, they're not suicidal, they don't follow the crowd. They were pushed off by a bulldozer. They herded the little mammals onto the edge of the cliff, got a bulldozer out, and ran at them. That's why they were jumping off the cliff. And you know you see them swimming out to sea to die. And they were dropping them off a boat and filming them. Anyway, sorry, that's Lemmings. But back to similarity. We've got 85% of people in the hotel recycle their towel. They changed the wording to be 85% of people staying in your room reuse their towel. Now, you'd expect, as a guest, that you're... opinion of the people staying in the room, your attitude towards them wouldn't be that favourable. They've contributed to the wear and tear of your bed, of the stains on the carpet, the fact the kettle doesn't work. But it increased towel reuse by 33%. So it's gone from 25 to 33 just by saying they stayed in your room. It makes absolutely no sense, but it's completely true. It's the same reason a good salesman will take off his time when he comes into a room full of people in t-shirts. He wants to be most similar to you. It's the same reason he also has a brother-in-law that lives in your hometown and went out with your sister when you were kids. It's got nothing to do with him being slimy, he's trying to exert his influence, his sales influence on you. Now, there's a couple of ways you can do this with products, things like card sorting exercises, that sort of like you're trying to get inside your users' heads, so you're trying to find out the language they use, you're trying to develop resonance with your users. On the web, we're quite fortunate in that we tend to get lots and lots of data and we get access to it. Like if it's installed, you don't get it. If it's on the web, it's all yours. And mining search boxes is something that very, very few people seem to do. But if you think about a search box, it's a little line into the heads of the people that are using your site. It's not just the words they use, it's also the associations they have between words. How do they feel about your product? What words are they looking for that you're not using? And you can mine not just your own search box, you can also mine the global search box. There are various tools out there for this. I know Word Tracker just because they're mates of mine. And I typed in Brighton to see what would come back. And it turns out that in Brighton, people say letting agents more than estate agents. They say apartment rental rather than flat rental. They're looking for clubs, not clubbing. They use guest houses as well as B&Bs. They use escorts, not companions or hookers. And florists are in really high demand. No, I just means you're not a typical user. And you can strike up a rapport, with things like this, similarity, familiarity. Although you've got to be aware of over-familiarity. Amazon, for some reason, it uses my first name whenever it sends me an email. Except that it uses the first name of my credit card, which is Michael. I go by Mike and have done since I was a kid. The only person that calls me Michael is my mum when I'm in trouble. So whenever I get an email from Amazon, I'm looking over my shoulder wondering what I've done. The neuro-linguistic programming lot, you know, with their body mirroring, their body language mirroring, yeah? That's supposed to breed rapport because if you're in an exchange with someone and a rapport has developed, you tend to mirror naturally. But this guy was mirroring very artificially. The journalist noticed, and instead of writing about NLP, he decided to write about how creepy this bloke was who was mirroring him. So it can completely backfire. But
that's true of most NLP processes.
I've never had the pleasure of meeting one. But you also get rapport with sites and applications, and it's with their kind of a similarity to your expectations and to the type of person you are. This was an exchange between the web, Stream Clellan, and Patrick Malcolm. And basically it's about how rubbish Gmail looks. But if you think about Gmail and you think about the audience, and you think about how it rolled out, firstly it rolled out with social proof. It was invite only. So immediately you get this sense of exclusivity, right? It's a little tweak to your ego. Your mate thought you were worthy. Or you have friends who know Google, you know, it's something like that. And if you think about how it looks bleeding edge, because it looks a little bit shit. it looks a bit unfinished. It's very, very functional. And it appeals to people like us. It appeals to people who like to feel that they're on the bleeding edge. So you can either think that it looks rubbish, or you can think that it's an incredibly clever design strategy which appeals to the right kind of people. It's also a great product that offered gigabytes and other people offered megabytes. I'm going to gloss over that bit because it doesn't really help the argument. Something like Monocle, if you read Dan Hill's write-up of Monocle, and the amount of time and effort they went in to making, it's a beautiful website, but making the beautiful website appropriate to their users, striking up a rapport with the kind of people they wanted to be using their website. It's tailored. All the ads they make themselves. You're not allowed to ship ads to Monocle. They did, I think it was Rolex ads. And the banners, rather than being a banner ad, were two little Rolex clocks like you might see on a scoreboard at a big sports game. It's very, very highbrow. And funnily enough, I actually think the same about MySpace. I think the design of MySpace, while it is rubbish, is entirely appropriate to what they were trying to do. It's nearly impossible to have a good-looking MySpace page, which means it's nearly impossible for a clique around quality to develop. It's a great leveler. Yeah, it's like Mario Kart. It's almost impossible to be unbeatable at Mario Kart. But yeah, okay, that's all. MySpace is almost impossible to have a beautiful page. And it may not be the fittest, but it is the most fit in the Darwinian sense. Survival of the fittest suggests that you have to be the fittest to survive. That's not what he meant. He meant you have to be the most appropriately fit to survive, or the most, or the fit enough to survive. And that's what MySpace is, and that's why it's done so well. Next one is reciprocity. So it's a great word for a start. But every culture has some concept of it. Marcel Mauss wrote a piece called The Gift, which is an ethnographic study. And he actually argues that there is no such thing as a free gift. Every gift carries with it some weight of some sort, some expectation. We've got Christmas, that's probably the biggest survivor, which actually goes back to the Romans, 200 BC, a little bit before Christ was actually born. But again, Egyptologist, sorry. Mauss calls gift exchange magical. Like, the property it has is almost impossible to explain. And if you can trick it, if you can trigger it, you get all sorts of benefits. And anyone who's been approached by a Krishna in the street and handed one of those books, that's exactly what they're doing. And I believe during the 70s, they were massive. They had something like 400 temples across America, all completely funded by reciprocal donations. They also had one guy who was observed. There were three of them operating in concert. And they had one guy who was handing out flowers and collecting money, and another guy who was staking out the nearest bin and collecting the flowers that everyone was throwing in the bin in disgust, taking them back to the first guy to sell them again. They were loaded. They got loads of money. You see reciprocation in ultimatum, the psychology game. You know, we have to decide how much you need to give someone in order to get the rest of the money. sorry, I'm just keeping myself amused. Baboons do it as well. They take it in turns to distract the alpha male so they can get some quality time with the lady baboons. And it's completely primeval, like it's pre-consciousness, but they have some concept of reciprocity. Another study was done on giving away mints at the end of a meal. So you've had your curry, you get your bill, you get your little plate of mints. They found that by giving mints, you had an average increase in tip by about 2 to 3%. Not a whole lot. If you give 2 mints, you get an increase of 12%. By giving more than the expectation, you trigger reciprocity. They tried a third variation, which was to give 1 mint each, and then the waiter would walk around and hand out 1 mint by hand to each person. And that got an average increase of 25% tip increase. Now, nothing's changed, just the approach, and they triggered reciprocity. You've got to be, again, quite careful with this, because people don't like feeling indebted. They did an insurance survey where they sent out $5 with the survey and $50 with the survey. And they had more responses from the $5 than the $50, because an insurance survey isn't worth $50 to the people who are receiving it. And I kind of suspect this is what's behind things like this, you know, the new Cadbury campaign, where they're not trying to jam their branding down your throats. All they're doing is giving you something. And you feel positively in response. And again, the same goes for virals. They're not asking for anything. They're giving you something and hoping that you're going to feel better about them. And I wouldn't mind betting there's something to free accounts in this as well. You're giving people a free service, which they know shouldn't be free. They know it's cost time. So how do people feel about the brand when they have a free service? I had a friend who bought a Last.fm Pro account. I said, "Oh right, you know, which of the Pro features was it you wanted?" He said, "No, I just felt that I owed them." It works, and all this is the basis for permission. This is an amazing book, Permission Marketing by Seth Godin. His argument is that you should not ask for anything without giving something, and you should have everything as a conversation. He wrote it in 96, it was way ahead of his time, it was mostly about email marketing. You know these websites that ask for email address in order to see what they do, to register, to log in. They've not given you anything. But you look at things like this. Now, this page looks rubbish, right? It's, of all things, it's a squeeze page about squeeze pages, so it's completely meta. But they give you valuable content, and then there's a call to action. So it's permission, it's reciprocity. And if you apply this to apps, this is Songkit, which is a lovely little service for finding live music. When bands come to town, they email you about new gigs, that sort of thing. And this is the interesting bit. Let us find you a concert. Let us give you something for free. You don't need to give us any details, just tell us a couple of things you like. We're not going to tie it to you in any way. And we're going to give you something. And this is the, as far as I'm concerned, this is the perfect first step in a permission experience, if you want to call it that. And the nice thing about, in fact, slightly unexpected thing about developing an experience as a permission system is it tends to require everything to be chunked, small pieces. And you can start to learn, and it turns out that people really, really enjoy learning. So the sheer exercise of one's functions is delightful. And there's an entire book about this, The Theory of Fun by Ralph Koster. And he basically argues that what humans are is learning machines. We love to learn. If you read the Wired article about the development of Halo, they found the most enjoyable thing was a consistent and appropriately challenging experience. We absolutely love to learn. If you think about the classic, it was the flies in the urinal. You know, it increases my half of the species' accuracy by a significant portion. And it's a game that we don't need to be taught to do. And it's learning in its own way. They happen to place the fly on exactly the point that gives the least splash back.
Is that scientific or opinion?
No, it's actually science. Believe it or not. It's
called airport.
Yeah, it's called airport. That's the one.
So I'm so excited that I actually found
it. I'm excited in context.
You are the world. I wanted to take a photo, but there were other people in the
Urinalfly.com. Buy them for your own toilet.
Urinalfly.com? Really?
Reduce the spillage by up to 80%.
Does it tell you where to place them?
Yes.
Oh, awesome. Right, and if there isn't, I'm starting that site. Fuck you all, it's my business. We are learning machines. We love to have fun. Next one, pattern matching. A lot of this comes from there's a chapter in Mindhacks about how we recall memories. We have neurons that get stimulated, and if the pattern of the stimulation is correct, a memory gets retrieved. This is how we know things. It's really reptilian. It's really mechanical. There's very little that sounds human about how we recall things. And there's this book here, which has the worst cover I've ever seen. And it actually has very, very little to do with chess. I can't explain why they've done that. But it's Sources of Power by Gary Klein. And his thing is studying how people make decisions. And until he did his research, which was mostly through the 70s, 80s, 90s, people assumed that we all make decisions based on evaluation. We would look at the evidence, and we would then choose one of the available options. He was studying people under pressure, people like firemen, tank commanders. Their first experiment, they've got the guy in his fire truck with his stopwatch and his clipboard ready to go, and they arrive at this burning house. And he doesn't even get time to start his stopwatch. The fireman straight into the house, straight up the burning building, find the injured guy, run straight back out again. They don't check the status of the building first. They know it by instinct. They don't stop to check on the state of the injury, whether moving him might kill him or hurt him more. Because if they don't get him out, the building's going to fall down. They know all this stuff from experience. They're not stopping to think about anything. It's 11 minutes from start to finish, from getting out of the fire truck to getting into hospital. It's 11 minutes. There's another story from, 1992 Gulf War, HMS Gloucester. They have an incoming blip on their radar, and none of the instruments can tell whether this is silkworm missile or a friendly plane. There's been a lot of traffic for friendly planes during the day. There's also been a fair number of silkworm missiles. This poor guy at his controls has no evidence to support his gut instinct that it is a missile. If he gets it wrong, he's either shooting down a friendly plane or his own ship is being missiled. He chooses to shoot it down, and it turns out he's right. And for years, no one could explain how he knew. And it turns out he was picking up on ultra subtle cues. I think what happened is this this plane had come, the lip had appeared just slightly inside of the lip, but there were no measurements to support this. It appeared just slightly inside, which meant that it was ascending, whereas if it was a plane, it should be descending. He's responding to these unconscious cues and he has nothing, he has no evidence to support. And this is the basis for pretty much all our conventions. We have things that we expect to see. We have patterns that we expect to encounter, and we react to them accordingly. It's where you get things like the Google effect. And actually what's interesting about the Google effect is, so this heat map here is the first time someone comes to the page. And people know to look for blue text, and they look for their keywords in the blue text. They might have a bit of a read of some of the copy, not all of it, just bits of it. And they will make a decision. We appear to act on the web as if we're under time pressure. We react the same way these tank commanders do, for some unknown reason, possibly because we know there's so much content, maybe it's not worth our time evaluating it. But if that first click doesn't come through, if it doesn't deliver what we expect, we go back to Google and we then scan the entire page. Sometimes people go as far as the third page. We switch from recognition primed to evaluative. But we're using these kind of reptilian cues from convention the very first time. And this is how we end up with things like this. This is a Jared Spool quote. Unfortunately, you quickly find out that expectations don't drive how users interact with our designs. That's because we're looking for conventions. We're looking for cues. My favorite example of queuing is this, which is from an article actually called Cues, which is on boxes and arrows. And this is about a large city that has a very large transport network. And they've made a individual and unique chime for every single station so that people can subconsciously absorb the sound of their station without ever having to look at the sign. It's the kind of thing that you learn unconsciously and grow to recognize. You may never know you've done it. And apparently commuters are learning not just the chime of their station, but the station before. So they know when to start getting ready to get off. And if you just try and sell this to someone, oh yeah, we want music, it's going to be in every station, it's going to be awesome. People just go, really? Really? Not a chance. But we have this incredible ability to associate things with other things in our minds. We have the PEG system for remembering numbers, where you have sounds for numbers and you can string sounds together because they're more memorable than abstract numbers. And that goes all the way back to 85 BC. We've known about this for an awful long time. Who was it? Cicero talked about it, apparently. The web told me. And one really blatant example of this kind of association, or learned association, is icons. And remember I said I was an Egyptologist? I've been dying to get this book out for the last 10 years, and I've never found an excuse. But this, for me, is an entire language with icons built into it, with queuing built into the language. For anyone that's interested, right, Egyptian phonetics. So most of these symbols are phonetic, not geographic. So that's a W, that's an H, that's a Y, or it's two Y's technically, and that's a T. But then this on the end, this last symbol on every word. Guess what that is? The last symbol is a cue as to what the word means. And they've got loads of them. They don't mean anything in themselves. All they are is a hint as to what the word might mean. It's to jog your memory. These are various things that a man might do. So various jobs. Carrying water on his head? Washing? I don't know. It doesn't really matter. It's just something to try and trick your memory into recalling more than it might be able to otherwise.
Women don't do much, do they?
It's the ancient world.
Oh, look, one's with a baby.
Oh, that's
okay. Yeah, I was going to gloss over that. But there's loads of these things. Women do about as much as invertebrate. Numerically speaking. And then we've brought icons straight back with everything we've done with computers. The work that Susan Kerr did with the Apple interface way back in the day, and then onto Windows 3.1. But queuing also turns up as colour. This is actually lovely, but this is the Dig visualizer for their news, where sections are coloured as an extra dimension to the visualization. I'm using it for score on my personal project. Let's get that. Every section on the business.gov.uk site is colour coded. You don't have to learn them, they just help if you know them. It's this kind of ambient signifier. Garrett Demon talks about this in his headers article, using colour as this kind of ambient signifier of how the bug is doing in his bug tracking system. Doppler use it for their cities. They've turned all places into a hex color, which is unique. And they don't matter, you don't need them. But if you happen to learn them, if you visit enough, you're rewarded with some extra meaning. So, natural limits. This is mostly about how the brain works and how we work with other people. This is a great study. It was this guy who went and studied 100 different writing systems and found that almost all of them limit their characters to 3 strokes. And his best guess as to why that is that 3 is the most we can count to without resorting... No, it's the most we can look at without resorting to counting and still grasp. I think there's a couple of African cultures that don't count beyond 3. Like, you don't have to develop counting, it turns out. You can get by without it, but it's an extra step. So that's the first number, 3, which is incredibly small. And this guy here, George Miller in 1957, wrote a paper called The Magical Number 7, trying to explain why he keeps finding the number 7 in various contexts. So you have... what have we got?
Dwarves.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, okay, yeah, 7 dwarves. And we've also got... what is it? Seven walking... 7's the... 7's
deadly
God's number.
Sins.
Oh, yeah, you've got 7 deadly sins.
Samurai.
Yes, okay, the 7 Samurai is my new favourite. My old favourite was going to be, and this is only because I watch QI late at night, 7 is also the number of clean animals that God told Moses to take on the ark, not 2. Yeah. So, geek. 7 turns up in all sorts of different contexts. And did a bunch of studies, and it turns out the number of things that we can remember without too much effort tends to top out at 7. It's about 5 to 7. So when you see things like this, that's why they're so bad. Okay, not only is it terrible, it's also got significantly more than 7 things in any part. But there's also a concept called chunking, where we can learn a series of actions and combine them into a single step, which we can then use as part of a longer chain. And that can extend our reach up to about 150 things if we use these chunking techniques. So if you want to perform a complex task, it requires practice. Like, we all know it. This is why it works. But the reason I like this number is because it's also Dunbar's number. Dunbar mostly studied apes back in the, I think it was in the 70s. And he found that ape troops tended to top out, I think it was 36. And at that point, the effort to groom each other, to maintain their social contact, became too much. Now, extend this to humans. We have language. And one of his arguments is actually that we develop language because it's a more efficient form of grooming. It's a more efficient way of keeping in touch with people. But he reckons that 150 is about the largest social network we can maintain if we're motivated. And this number turns up in various other ethnographic studies. So, size of Neolithic farming villages, Hussite settlements, number of academics in a discipline, basic unit size of armies in ancient Rome, appropriate company size. It also turns up as about the upper bound of guilds in Ultramar Online, which is very important. There are a couple of other numbers as well. We have 30 to 50, which is roughly extended family size. You get to 100 to 200, around that sort of range, which is clan size. And you've got an upper bound, which is 500 to 2,500, which I don't know how they arrived at that. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, but it's about a small settlement size. We also find agile teams start to break down around at 15, that sort of number. And it's the reason that I don't consider MySpace to be social software. And it's the reason that Facebook are hurrying to give us tools to help manage the number of friends we have and how we communicate with them. So we can chunk our friends into groups, which we can then socialize with. And the final thing is stories. This is the thing that I think is the most important. It's also the thing that I'm least sure what to do with. Stories are one of the most fundamental mechanisms we have for conveying information. Anecdotes. I think this picture here goes back about 32,000 years, these kind of looks like a scene from some from a story in some way. You can imagine it being recited or being used as an illustration for a recital of something. You've got things like the Epic of Gilgamesh, the Iliad, the Odyssey, which are transmitted orally, which are phenomenally long, but Greek kids were expected to learn them from end to end. And I suspect the only reason they could even hope to do that is because they're stories, and we're very, very well equipped to remember stories. I was lucky enough to spend a couple of days with a guy called Dave Snowden, who founded Kenethon as part of something called Sensemaking. He used to be a business anthropologist. And one of the things he did was study plumbers at work. And he was sent in as a management consultant. He was working for, I think, IBM at the time. And so he spent a week climbing in and out of drain pipes, covered in shit, doing the jobs that no one else wanted to do because they were trying to make him quit. And after a week, he kind of earned their respect. And they allowed him to start hanging out with them properly. And it turns out that every morning, before they started work, they'd make a cup of tea, and they'd spend half an hour sitting around, just chatting about work, exchanging anecdotes. They got another management consultant who said they were wasting half an hour a day drinking tea. Management took away their kettle. He goes back 6 months later to see how they're doing, and goes out for a day with this guy that he'd been hanging out with when he was there the first time. And on the way back, they take him to a greasy spoon that happens to be near where they work. Walks in, orders their beans and tea. And this guy goes, right, yeah, give him the ledger. And the guy pulls out this massive book from behind the counter, hands it to Dave. They go back, sit down, opens the book, and it's a book of anecdotes. It's a book of anecdotes about plumbing. They've decided to work around management and write down their stories about work so they can all get better at work. It's very similar to the work that was done in Xerox PARC back in the early 80s. Their least successful ever manual was one that was purely prescriptive. It was, if this happens, do this. Whereas the way the engineers tended to work was much more socially. They would exchange stories about how things worked, and they would slowly learn the mechanics of their machines, and they'd learn to develop their own solutions. Another story from Sources of Power was nurses specialising in prematurely born babies. The result of that study was to write training material that was entirely composed of anecdotes, all the cues to signal infection in a prematurely born baby were encoded in these stories, which the nurses then found very easy to remember. I'm not going to bother with that. There we go, straight into this. This, I don't know, like I said, I'm not really sure what to do with stories. I'm really struggling. People are starting to talk about user experience in terms of storytelling, which is fascinating, but that's not all there is to it. It can also be used in much smaller contexts. And this is a little help message that I'm trying to put together. And it was mostly inspired by an article that Seth Godin wrote a little while ago about being remarkable. And it wasn't about your product being remarkable, it was about your message being conveyed in remarks. So I'm trying to design a product proposition that is almost in anecdote form and is designed to be conveyed orally to other people. I'm trying to get the idea of the product viral outside of the computer, and maybe it'll work, maybe it won't, but I'm sure there's way, way more opportunities for this sort of thing in software in particular, but someone else will have to do it. That's it. I'm done. Thanks very much to these books, thanks very much to these papers, thanks very much to these photos. I'm done. Well, actually, if you've got a minute, this is not related to anything at all, and I've only just seen it. I've cut it out because I couldn't make it relevant, but it's one of my favourite stories ever. Lift buttons, I found this on holiday, I'll be real quick, right? So look at the ones that are most great. Ground, fair amount. The thing is, everyone goes to the ground. Second floor, I think that's got the most rooms on it, and possibly people the most lazy things. I don't know, I'm not sure. Can't figure it out. And the door close button, that's pressed even more than the ground button. And what's interesting about this photo is this. Turns out that elevators built since the 90s don't have working door close buttons. They're simply there to reassure you when you're in your metal box suspended over a giant hole by a piece of string that you're still in control. And it's important enough to people to feel in control that lift designers are still putting door close buttons in their lifts.
There is actually a little bit more to door close buttons. And sometimes they operate like a hack mode.
I heard that when the firemen are in, sometimes they will work.
Lift engineers, there are certain combinations of key presses that basically allow it to go express and bypass anyone.
So close buttons are like an Easter egg?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, there are websites I've heard. Apparently, there's a Lift Geek.
Oh, that's nice. That's really good.
Especially the cheap modes for all these elevators.
Okay, so there are cheap modes for elevated door clothes.
That's awesome. The only thing I just want.
That's my new favourite fact. Okay, now I'm really done. Thank you very much.
I'm interested in the heat map that you showed Google.
Do you want me to bring that up?
You can if you want to.
Go on, carry on talking. Okay. I'll be fine. Well,
what I'm interested in is that, to my knowledge, most heat map software works within one tab. And given that tab browsing is becoming much more prominent, how the heat map is actually affected. Do you scan and open as you do? And that would not necessarily be tracked.
This study goes back 2 or 3 years, so it kind of predates a lot of tabbing. And as far as I understand, tab browsing is still an elite feature.
Okay.
Well, it'll develop, but I mean, IE's only had tab browsing for one version, which basically means...
Yeah, I'm surprised. So my next question is then, what's the way to track that, and is there anything
about it? So how might you track tabbed browsing? No idea. I can kind of imagine people splitting their time. How do you gauge which of their time slices are appropriate? No, I've got no idea.
That information hasn't come from like any kind of plugin. That's just from actually pointing camera
data
size. So it's not the mouse movement; it's the eye movement that they're mapping onto the.
Right.
It's an eye tracking test.
Yep.
So there's been some of the stuff you come across and you can say so it's really quite astute. That's an observation. How do you personally then reapply that to the work that you do?
So it's
one thing to observe something, it's another thing to actually apply.
How do you apply this stuff to something like design? A lot of it possibly. Subconsciously, but some of it is much more obviously useful, like the permission idea, the idea that you don't ask for anything without giving something of value, tends to be fairly easy to apply in all sorts of different contexts. So if you think of it in an induction, what can you offer your new user that they didn't know before you ask them to do anything that might cost them time? It seems sensible from a point, it's the same idea to front loading content. If you're a journalist, you want your key points in the first two lines. And if you can give them something valuable in the first two lines, then perhaps they'll spend the rest of their time with you. What else have I covered? I'm going to flick through my slides.
Were you going to open the slides table?
Yeah, I'll put them up for sure.
I think the problem isn't trying to find how this stuff can be applicable.
Yeah.
It's actually remembering to apply it. I mean, this is one of the things I find, there are basic things, there are basic usability things, or basic user experience stuff. But it's really easy to get focused on your day-to-day life in the small details, to forget the big picture.
I think it's a lot easier when you're working on a product, particularly, and probably not in an agency environment. I'm lucky enough to be able to spend time sitting and thinking about stuff. I tend not to have tight deadlines, billable hours that I have to be accountable for. I have the luxury of time, basically, which you probably don't have.
I guess that's not my question, really, or not my point. I think it's really easy to overlook the basics by focusing on the minutia. And I just wonder whether just something stupid like sitting there with like your 8 key points. Stuck behind your computer, and whenever you're analysing or evaluating a wireframe, thinking, "Oh, I forgot to add some reciprocity into this wireframe," or
have a conversation with my user.
I actually find this quite a lot. I found this just the other day with the redesign of the message I showed you at the end. I realised that I'd not made anything obviously clickable. I think one of my favourite things from Matt Webb's talk at Deconstruct last year was the light from above idea. If you remember that, it's basically we've grown up in a world that has the sun, put simply. We're used to light coming from above. And we've developed a visual system that will look for objects that have the light from above them and make them pop. We're used to hunting, we're used to looking for stuff. It's the same reason that a gazelle is dark on the top and light on the bottom. It's trying to flatten itself against its background and counteract the effect of sun from above. And I realised, looking at my design, I had this... No, it looked quite pretty, I was quite pleased with it. And I came back to it the next day and I couldn't figure out what the bloody hell I was supposed to be clicking. And actually just adding highlights and lowlights to the things that were supposed to be clickable, that were supposed to be buttons that I cleverly made not look like buttons, helped massively. And it's something really, really, really simple. But I hadn't spotted it and I didn't think about it. And
this is the problem I find. I look at wireframes, which are really well constructed, and the logic's there and the motivation's there, and I think, but what's the core action? You know, what is the one core thing that you want users to do? And people will focus so much on the minutiae and the edge cases that you actually, this stuff is so obvious, it becomes unobvious in a way.
A lot of it, the permission stuff in particular is more of a philosophy. And if you can design with the philosophy that you're not going to expect anything without giving something in return, it's not so bad.
I think that's the same thing with a lot of these things that you've talked about. I'm totally with you. And I think that what you have to do is just kind of meditate on them until they're totally in your mind. And then you use like various processes to kind of make sure that you employ as much of this stuff. And use a set of design processes kind of help you to not forget these things. And the act of testing.
Yeah, what should users fail to fail to find the buttons that you haven't made look like a button?
Is it also about stating up front? In the previous talk, someone said, you know, like stating what is your win state. If you can make obvious that, if you can state to a team that you're working with, because I think it's better to extrapolate that, say it's a group of people working together, not an individual designer, because everyone's responsible for delivering the system. If you can say, this is what we're aiming to do at the beginning, and then at each point...
Actually explain it to the team and then let the team remind you as well.
And if you can, use
metrics, you can say, does it do that?
I think one of the important things is also to go into this with a sense of aggression, from the idea that, you know, Mike identified a series of things. You can't always play all of them at once, and what's really interesting is when you apply one thing to its logical endpoint. Pitlands is probably a really good example. Pitlands, I don't know if you use it, it's Firefox extension.
I don't know how I got by without Pitlands. I now can't imagine life without it.
What's fascinating about it is this is an aggressive thing about bringing images to the front. I did some design work recently, and in the end I was staring at this page, I was trying to fit a million and one things onto it, and they were all listed as being important. And so rather than looking at the existing page and looking at all the requirements, I went back to the very first document the client had given us, and it had a very interesting statement. I said, right, all this page is meant to do is this and this. What would it look like if it didn't do anything else? What if I took one of these ideas, not all 8 of them, but took one of them, and was incredibly aggressive and said, you know what, people just want to see pictures.
So trying the most extreme thing you could possibly try.
If I just put a screen full of pictures and nothing else on, you wouldn't know where they were coming from, you wouldn't know what the ratings on them were, you'd have to hover over them before you could know anything useful. But in terms of delivering you a screen full of pictures, it's incredibly successful. And sometimes you sort of have to push yourself out to these edges, because a lot of the time you get into a very safe center where you're trying to apply every single thing you know all at once. And sometimes it doesn't always work. And I looked at this page and went, this is a disaster. This is the opposite of what they've said they liked. And it turned out that they asked me to be really aggressive on a particular page, and I decided that page was fine. And instead, I applied the aggression they were asking for to everything else. And they were very enthusiastic in the end, which was really weird, because I was terrified. Because I thought, I've just gone and applied the simplicity they didn't want everywhere else. But actually, it sometimes takes that. And so trying to say, okay, let's just take this and run with it. Even if you throw it away, trying to see what your extreme ends are. So what's your win state for most pictures on screen at once? And what's your win state for most metadata? And they're pretty much polar opposites. And in that sense of just trying to take something really very aggressively, not to any successful purpose, but just because otherwise you end up trying to put everything on the same page.
Now, there's other things like that. Even when you think that you understand all of these things, something comes along and surprises you.
I definitely don't understand all of these things.
It's really
I'm constantly wrong. But as long as you're prepared to be wrong, you don't do it again. Like, what the hell? It's all good.
I think like teams of people, you might forget to apply some of these things, but teams of people who are fascinated by these things tend to produce better stuff. I think that's the
I've
thing.
I've been very lucky to work with, I guess it tends to be specialists with other interests, more or less. So I've worked with programmers who have an interest in something, and that's awesome. Because even though they don't necessarily do my job, they contribute as well. I worked with a Python programmer turned Ruby, who used to come in the morning and mock up interfaces in OmniRaffle. Not because he necessarily wanted the interfaces done, but he had this idea on the way in and wanted to explain it to me. And then we'd sit there and we'd collaborate on it, and that was one of my favourite working experiences ever. But yeah, getting people who appreciate that their job isn't just their job and the end result is their job is great. Anyone else?
Yeah. I'm just interested that from the sources you had at the beginning about suicide rates, etc.
Yeah.
Not that I'm planning anything malicious, but if those stats have changed over time as different mediums, i.e. radio, TV, internet,
is social proof becoming...
What is
the penetration of social proof increasing? Is it reaching more people?
Is it causing... decreasing, but what is the ratio?
Yeah, I've got no idea. But there's a big thing about what's right for the press to do. Because it's been documented for a long time that something like a high school shooting, there's a good chance it'll trigger another high school shooting. It's not that it makes people do stuff they wouldn't do already, but it makes it okay for them to do it. And so there's a big thing about whether the press ought to be reporting
that
the shootings in the States in the way that they do. Yeah, therefore it's okay for
in
fact, there was a really interesting thing on the news the other day about this, about the teenagers and knives. They had a protest in Islington where rather than having the talking heads on TV saying, you know, kids are carrying knives are bad, they had kids on the street saying that knives are bad.
Organised through Facebook.
What's that?
They organised themselves through Facebook.
Oh, did they?
So it wasn't top down, it was a grassroots.
Ah, fantastic. Right, so even better. Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely the way to go.
About social norms for sexuality. So there's been a book published or something with Metro, where obviously we're quite keen on the whole story. And what they're saying is that the internet connecting everyone together means that more niche interests are actually more accessible.
Yeah, so, they've had a bit of a rant about this a couple of years ago with the guy that now works for us. About we manufacture the internet lets us manufacture our own echo chambers. So for a gay kid growing up in Iowa, he gets a support network. For a paedophile growing up in New York, he gets people that say it's okay to do what he does. And I think I was talking just earlier about news as well. I think we do the same with personalization. The fact that we can subscribe to our own news sources is incredibly dangerous. I was having an argument with my dad about the most recent Gulf War. And he was very for it and I was very against it. And all the evidence he cited came from the Times, and all the evidence I cited came from the Guardian. And there was nothing else to it. I went and looked it up. I read a white paper by a Canadian think tank who said that actually both sides are right. There's enough evidence to justify either case. It's completely down to your philosophy, your politics, and the news sources you choose to read. Which is, it's a very scary idea with everyone pushing personalization, customization, RSS, everyone should be
in personalization. You don't have
Yeah.
When everything's so tailored towards what you already
Yeah,
love.
Absolutely. There's no opportunity to be challenged. I met a guy a little while ago who's doing a not-for-profit based around debating. It's geared at debating, but for the debating audience, not for the debaters themselves. But the point there is when you're debating, you have two completely opposing views, and they are trying to convert the audience to their point of view, but they're two diametrically opposed views and you're forced to listen to both. I'd love to see a news service which would offer me both extremes of the news story. Just give me some evidence to make up my own mind, but this isn't where the web seems to be going.
I think it'd be really cool if Amazon had it. Like, people who bought this book have never bought this book. I would buy those.
Well, my personal project is, well, it was originally going to be geek reviews. My problem was that I've not got a great memory. And I saw a lot of gigs last year, and I was at a gig towards the end of last year, and I turned to Bob and was like, she's really good. And he went, yeah, we've seen her before. It's like, oh, shit. Right, I can't remember what I've seen. So I wrote a little app to let me review stuff on the way home. And one of the things I was going to use to help people gauge other users they're most like was their favourite thing and their least favourite thing, because they're both really useful yardsticks for what people are into. So yeah, absolutely. Like, things that people definitely didn't buy from Amazon, I think would be quite interesting. Although,
surely it's
I struggle to think what might turn up.
Jumping onto politics as a topic. One of my friends looked at what appeared in mainstream media under politics and what appeared in Digg's category of politics.
So the classification of politics?
Yeah, in media. And actually, if you look what appeared in mainstream versus Digg, the two were very opposite.
In terms of the kind of thing that might turn up classed as politics?
Yes.
Because there was that advert, I think it was on the radio and on TV last year for trying to encourage people to vote, where one side says, "I'm not into politics," and the other guy says, "Buses."
Yeah.
You know, and it's all about politics. So that should be quite an interesting middle ground to look for. What does everyone consider politics, and what do each side consider politics?
What basically happened was, where there was an agenda of someone high up, it didn't appear in the mainstream, and the exact opposite for Dick, where there was an agenda, they flagged it up, or where it was mainstream, it actually had very little in the way of Dick votes.
Okay.
So they became complete opposites. Yeah,
interesting. I'll have a look at that.
Another thing that sprung to mind, we were talking about numbers of things, numbers of friends.
Yeah.
I mean, it's obviously incredibly open to misuse. We were talking about Darren Brown earlier on, but he talks about the kind of MMR thing, and someone who's had a child who's gone through the MMR thing, and that was a classic case of where this was incredibly misused in terms of numbers. So,
and that's social proof as well.
Yeah.
If other mums are not getting their MMR draft, then I should.
Then it must be okay for me.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, that's kind of the point I was trying to make. You know, it just is a classic.
Well, it's funny, once you've been told there are names for these things, they start turning up everywhere. You find that a lot. It's like the power of giving something a name, which is what Tom was talking about as well. Once you have a label for something, you can start remembering it. And honestly, it's everywhere. Social proof is used. In fact, all these forms of influence are used all over the shop, by papers, by journalists, by marketers, by PR people. They're incredibly powerful, but they don't seem to have reached designers, or not as much as I thought they might have done.
It happens subconsciously. I mean, social proof is used, for instance, to
yeah, we use it intuitively, as designers. But I'm just surprised that we don't read the same books.
Yeah, true. I mean, I just want to say two things. First of all, George Oates is very, very clever when they set up Flickr. They use social proof by encouraging right behaviour, by inviting people into the group.
And then behaving that way themselves as well. Yeah.
Dig does exactly the opposite. The reason Dig fell down a couple of years ago is because the social proof was you have to act like an adolescent arsehole. And everyone saw, oh, this is the way everyone uses Dig, this is how I must use Dig.
So perhaps
really, really difficult.
If the community doesn't start out well, it makes its own norms, and everyone new adopts those norms. You look at YouTube as well, famously vitriolic.
Famously illiterate.
It also happens
in niche communities. You look at people on Twitter's a really interesting one, because you look at people who have problems with it, and it's very hard to say to them that you're using it. But there are only clusters where people, when they work in small clusters, all use it in a similar way. So if you watch how Robert Scoble uses it, Robert Scoble breaks everything because he wants it all to work the way he works, which is like no other user. He's not the user, he's the precise opposite of the user. And you get this interesting thing where if they're using it wrong, does it matter if they're still using it successfully? And that probably the answer is not until they just start complaining about it. And this was an interesting Doppler wrote out, where they were trying to write out the idea of when they said, when we say friends, we mean like actual friends. Well, they never said friends, which is an important part of it, but they basically said this service works with people you know in real life and whom you trust. And it was actually very interesting breaking people out of habits that they only have online.
The nice thing about Doppler, or the reason that I think services like Docker can succeed, because they do actually impact your real life, and they have things, they have, because it is about your real life, there you have accountability built in.
Yeah, the social value built in.
And I kind of think that anything that wants to be social should be building in some form of accountability, even just like a mobile phone number or a postcode. Something that plants the seed that you may be answerable in the real world.
It's value shared amongst the group. The value is shared between the members of the group rather than individually. So, you know, when I
was also here,
we have an agreement between us, which is we both know each other's phone numbers, and there's a value in the middle of that. And the problem is when you just add people to a friends list without impact on anything, there's no shared
value. But it's much more basic level. If you're an asshole to me in real life, I'll punch you. which isn't something that you necessarily risk if you insult me on DID. Like there's real accountability right there.
But I might fight you as a zombie. Yeah.
Whatever, I'm a fucking pirate.
Yahoo's just published all their patterns for the community.
Yeah, those are interesting as well, like, especially the gaming aspect of the Yahoo patterns.
So what they've done is they've published this idea of a competitive spectrum. And so by identifying your community and seeing where it sits on a spectrum from all the way from kind of caring to competent, then there's, I don't know why they'll start with C, but there's like five of them. And as soon as you can sort of say, well, what kind of motivations are people using, what motivations do people have for using this community? And so what kind of culture am I trying to create? Then you can say, okay.
And then choose the appropriate pattern based on the community.
Yeah, so your reputation system, whatever you design into it, will then be, will try and encourage those behaviors. So obviously, if you've got something that's gaming related and you want a competitive leaderboard type mentality, then that's fine. You can give people points, publish those points, and people will be fighting each other for those
points. Sort of implies that, well, I suppose it's obvious once they've said everyone should have a strategy for the kind of community they're trying to build.
Yeah.
So a community building strategy, which is the behaviours they want, and then design appropriately. But no, I've not built that kind of site, so I've never really thought about it. But yeah, that makes complete sense.
You just had in your head, though, well, what kind of culture do I want to engender, and what behaviours support that culture? Mm. Then you look at the value that someone, like each interaction should be given some kind of value. And it might be that it's points driven, and it's like, yeah, the more you do, the more you get, and then you win badges or whatever. Or it might be actually, well, what does the community value in what I've contributed? So it's not just the sheer number of shit comments I've put on everything, but actually what have people voted me up or down or whatever.
Exposing that and using social proof as a motivator.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Sounds like PageRank.
Except it's entirely community contributed.
And whatever system you use to rank it is based on what kind of community you want to build.
PageRank is community built.
Well,
over the community of the internet.
PageRank is similar to what Cory Doctorow's idea of Woofy, isn't it? Except
it's more about page policy.
Because you start with one and you give
like selfish, like you selfishly link to something because you're interested in it. Yeah.
No, but you get so
which is the opposite of community.
PageRank is also PageRank is totally unbalanced and unweighted. Everyone counts the same, and that's not true.
I
believe they're weighted. That they're open.
Or something like that.
Oh yeah. Sorry, did you want to?
Before we get to the part, I just want to add one little thing. This confirmation is just like one example of cognitive bias. You know, if we were completely logical beings, we'd try and find out all the facts for ourselves in order to make a decision. Yeah. We don't do that. We use there's loads of different cognitive biases. So if anyone's interested in this kind of stuff, there's a really good page on Wikipedia called cognitive biases, and there's something like 150 different ones on there, they're all this interesting and all this useful. Have a look at that if this is interesting to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mike.